Hey folks, how are you? Hey, it's time, so I'm going to get started. I notice my video is lagging a little bit, so if you're having trouble, just let me know. I'll turn off my video because sometimes that makes a difference. So okay, so let's in the last session we were talking about the pricing, and we looked at lots of different examples, right? Price to book with banks, price earnings of beverage companies. And I cheated in what sense? Every single sector I use, I was able to explain the differences across companies using ROE or margins or growth rates. And the reason I said I cheated is that sometimes and this might happen with your company, when you pick up the peer group and you put them in a chart, you realize very quickly there is no pattern, right? So I'll make this real. 20 plus years ago, remember I showed you my Amazon valuation from January 2000, way back in time, peak of the dot-com boom. I decided to price Amazon. I'd done an intrinsic valuation of Amazon. And I wanted to price Amazon. So here's what I did. I went and looked up the price to sales ratio, and I'm cheating. I should have used EV to sales. In hindsight, I wish I had. I took the price to sales ratio of every dot-com company, and I put them on a graph. Take a look at the scatter plot. What's the first thing that jumps out when you look at it? It's a shotgun blast, right? There's no pattern here. Everything seems to be all over the place. So when I looked at price to sales versus margins, which is supposed to be what drives the difference, there seems to be no relationship. The plot should have given it away, but I decided to try it anyway. I basically decided to do a regression. And the regression basically revealed what the chart was showing, which is there's almost no relationship. The R squared is close to zero. And in fact, in this graph at least, you get a very strange result. As my margin goes up, take a look at what happens to the coefficient on the net margin. It's negative. In other words, the more negative my net margin, the higher my price to sales ratio as a company. Saying that makes no sense. Remember, in pricing, the question you don't ask is, does that make sense? Is you the question asking, what is the data telling me? And at least in this data, there seems to be no relationship between price to sales and margin. If you try to force me into a linkage there, it seems to be a negative linkage. The more negative my net margin, the higher my price to sales ratio. I don't know whether any of you is valuing a cannabis stock or an artificial intelligence company or an electric car company. Because you're going to face the same challenge that I face, right? You take every electric car company in the world, you put in a scatter plot, every one of them is losing money. In fact, in 2000, when I did this with dot-com stocks, every single stock was losing money except for one. I think AOL was the only company making money. Every one of these companies is money losing. There's no link between margins and price to sales. You're saying, what do I do now? Here's the one thing you cannot do. Don't try to make the data bend to your views. In other words, you say, this doesn't make sense. I'm going to mess with the data until it works. The data is what it is. So I'll give you a couple of things you can do if you're in a sector where nothing seems to make sense right now. One is you can use proxies. Proxies for what? Think of the things that make some companies in this space more valuable than others. Okay. I'll give you an example. Amazon in early 2000. I'm going to throw three hypotheses out and you tell me what you think. Remember, the price to sales ratio is the multiple of revenues you're willing to pay for a company, right? My first hypothesis, the bigger your revenues as a company, the lower your price to sales ratio should be. And let me explain why. If you have only $1 million in revenues, trading at 100 times revenues is not a big deal. You have $1 billion in revenues, it gets more difficult. So scaling up is often going to push the... So the first hypothesis I had is the larger my revenues, the lower my price to sales ratio. Second, I said growth matters, but it's not growth and profits. They're all losing money, but growth and revenues. Higher revenue growth companies should trade at higher multiples of revenues than lower revenue growth companies. And third, I know many of these companies will not make it. Why? These are young companies in a space where cash is constrained. They run out of cash. So I put in a survival variable. And the way I came up with the survival proxies, I looked at how much cash these companies had on their balance sheets as a percentage of revenues, arguing that companies with more cash should be more likely to survive than companies with less cash. So my argument was, I'm not going to look at traditional metrics. I'm going to argue that bigger companies in terms of revenue should trade at lower price to sales ratios. Higher revenue growth companies should trade at higher price to sales ratios. And companies with more cash should trade at higher price to sales ratios. That's my hypothesis. I ran a regression of price to sales against the log of revenues. We'll talk a little bit about why we use logs sometimes and not others. Revenue growth and cash as a percent of revenue. It actually, log of revenues is actually statistically very marginal.
Professor, the slides are not moving. The slides are not moving.
That's probably my internet is acting up. So let me turn off my video. You see slide 77, or are you still stuck on 76?
Now 77, yes.
Okay. And let me move forward. Tell me whether the slides are moving with you. You see 78 now? Okay. So I'm going to keep my video off. There's something wrong with my broadband today. And let me go back to 77. So basically, I use the level of revenues, revenue growth, and cash as a percent of revenues. The R squared I got for the regression was about 32%. Am I happy about that? In this sector, that's about as good as it's going to get. This is a very young, noisy sector. The 32% R squared is not something I want to boast about, but it's about as good as I'm going to get. The higher my revenues, the lower my price to sales ratio. That kind of makes sense given my hypothesis. The higher the growth rate, the higher the price to sales ratio. And the more cash I have as a company, the higher my price to sales ratio. I plugged in Amazon's numbers into that regression. I got a predicted price to sales ratio of 30.42. Their actual price to sales ratio is 25.63. Remember I said I did this at the same time that I did my intrinsic valuation of Amazon? You remember my intrinsic valuation of Amazon gave me a value of about $35 per share. The stock was trading at 84 and I concluded the stock was significantly overpriced. At the same time, I'm actually giving you this analysis that suggests that Amazon is actually undervalued. In other words, I'm making the claim that it's both overvalued and undervalued at the same time. And this was going to be one of my start of the class tests, but rather than use it, I'm going to use Amazon to ask this question. How can a stock be both overvalued and undervalued at the same time? I mean, because in this case, with my intrinsic valuation, I'm claiming Amazon is overvalued, right? It's trading at 84, it should be trading at 35. But when I do this analysis, I'm suggesting Amazon is undervalued. How can I make both statements and argue that I'm being internally consistent? What's the difference between those two statements? Genoa?
Maybe the whole internet sector are overvalued a lot.
In other words, when I make the statement that Amazon is undervalued, it's a qualified statement, right? In fact, what should I be saying? Given how other dot-com stocks are priced, Amazon looks cheap. Whereas when I did my intrinsic valuation, what's the statement I was making? Given the expected cash flows, the risk and the growth rate in Amazon, Amazon looks overvalued. You know what? A year later, I'd have been right on both counts. When in usual terms, I was right on both. Because here's what happened. Over the next year, Amazon lost 80% of its value, which kind of backs up my intrinsic valuation, right? But it lost only 80%. You say, what do you mean only 80%? You know what the rest of the dot-com sector did? It was down 92%. Basically, in a pricing, you're making a conditional statement. Remember that when you get the pricing for your company, that what you find in your intrinsic valuation might not match up to what you get in your pricing. In this case, Amazon is overvalued on an intrinsic value basis, but undervalued when you look at an appraisal. So one way to do this, to deal with companies, especially young companies, is to use other proxies, things you think might matter. I mean, in a little while, I'm going to show you another proxy that I use with social media companies. And you're going to see that with pricing, you're allowed to kind of break the mold. You're not stuck with free cash flow to the firm growth and discount rates the way you were with intrinsic valuation. Here's the other way you can deal with young companies. One of the problems we've faced with young companies is there's not much substance there right now. You know what I mean by that? The revenues are small, you're losing money. And the reason the pricing is not working is you're trying to force a pricing on a company that's not quite ready for it. So if you're looking at a NIO, for instance, young electric car company, you put today's revenues and today's margins and today's cash flows, there's not much there. You're getting a pricing that doesn't make sense. So here's what you can do. Instead of using today's numbers, what if you went to year 5 or year 10? You're saying, what's going to happen by then? Remember, if you have a growing company by year 5 or year 10, your revenues are going to be much bigger. You might even be making money. It's called a forward multiple. Basically, what you're doing is instead of applying the multiple to today's numbers, you're estimating what that multiple will look like if you applied them on year 5 or year 10 numbers. And because you've done your intrinsic valuation already, this should be relatively straightforward, right? If I asked you, what's your revenue in year 10? You go to your DCF, there's your revenue in year 10. So trying to estimate a multiple of revenues on today's revenues or today's earnings, you apply it on year 10 numbers. The one thing you have to be careful about is if you take year 10 numbers for your company, you apply them, so let's say your year 10 revenues are $30 billion. And you decide that the multiple of revenues you'd pay would be 3x revenues. 3x 30 billion is 90 billion, right? But that's in year 10. You know what you still have to do, right? To get the value today, because you're paying for the stock today, you got to bring it back to today. To illustrate how much effect this is going to have, I'm going to show you the effects of all of these intermediate time periods on a valuation I did for Tesla way back in time. So this is like my very first valuation of Tesla. Now people were surprised because my estimated value, my terminal value was almost 68 billion. But the value that I gave for the company was about 8 billion. You say, how did you get from 68 to 8 billion? What happened? So I actually did a post on what happens as you get from year 10 to today. So first thing I did is if I just discount back at the risk-free rate, it's kind of minimal discounting, 68 billion becomes 52 billion. That's just a pure risk-free rate discounting. If I discounted the cost of capital, 68 billion becomes 28 billion. So the risk effect means that 68 billion 10 years from now is worth only 28 billion today. If you're doing forward pricing, at least do that. Bring it back to today at the cost of equity or cost of capital. Remember, depending on whether you're looking at equity value or firm value, because you're looking at the value today. In the case of Tesla, I went further. Because I did my full-fledged cash flows, I had negative cash flows for the first 5 years. Remember, that's going to dilute my value, and that dilution cost me another $15 billion. Then you adjust for failure risk and debt and cash. You can see how very quickly your 68 billion terminal value becomes 8 billion today. For those of you valuing young growth companies, the Squares, the Neos, even the PayPals, Teslas. I want you to take a look at your DCF. Look at your terminal value and look at the value of equity today. And I want you to go through this exercise, if nothing else, that you're ready when somebody asks, well, how come your terminal value is 150 billion, but you're telling me the value of the company is only 30 billion today? There's many a slip between the cup and the lip. In this case, being explicit about it will allow you to see where value drains away. So if you're pricing a young company, and many of you are pricing a young company, don't try to do the pricing with today's numbers. Try to do them with year 5 or year 10 numbers from your spreadsheet, because that'll be a more tangible number, a bigger number, a more reasonable number that better captures your company. But then remember, after you get that forward pricing, you got to still bring it back to today. You can do it, you know, completely, or you can at least do the first three steps, right? Discount it back at the cost of capital today, because that's the number you're comparing to the value of the equity today. Any questions? And here's the third possible way you can approach young companies. In 2013, Twitter went public, and I did an intrinsic valuation of Twitter on my website. On my blog. And then I decided to do a pricing of Twitter. Why? Because IPOs are a pricing game. So here's what I did. I collected what were then publicly traded social media companies. You have Facebook, LinkedIn, Pandora, Groupon, Netflix, et cetera. I got the market cap of each company, enterprise value, revenues, EBITDA, net income. So first I wanted to get the financial numbers of these companies to see if I could explain the differences in market cap. But I also collected the number of users in millions that each company had. In 2013, Facebook had about 1.23 billion users, and Yelp had only about 120 million users. So basically for each company, I collected the number of users. Then I did a bunch of multiples, EV to sales, EV to EBITDA, EV to EBIT, EV to user. You can compute EV to any number, right? There's no theory here. And the question you're asking is, which one of these best explains these companies? So rather than me making that choice, here's what I fell back on. I want to use the metric that best explains what's happening in the market. Let me repeat that again. When I look at a pricing metric, I want to use the metric that the market is using to price companies, because that's what pricing is all about. So what I did was I did a correlation between the market cap of these companies with revenues, EBITDA, net income, the accounting numbers, and with the number of users. So take market cap, go down this first column. The higher the correlation, the more it's explaining differences across companies. Now, enterprise value and market cap obviously are very highly correlated because the two are basically almost the same number for most companies. But if you look at the other four variables, take a look at what variable best explains differences in market cap across companies. It's number of users. The larger the number of users at a company, the greater the market cap of the company. In fact, if you look at the previous page, the market seems to be paying about 130 per user on average, but let's say the median value, about $100 per user. Number of users best explains different market cap. Twitter at 240 million users on its IPO. You know how I'd price Twitter? I'd take 240 million users, multiply by $100, you get $24 billion. That would have almost perfectly explained what you saw happening on the offering day to Twitter stock price. If you can explain differences in prices with number of users, number of downloads, nothing stops you from using that to price your company. The biggest trick here, though, is to get the number of users. That took me the most work here because I had to go to an external. This is not an S&P Capital IQ. I wish you could pull it up. I had to go pull it up from a couple of different sites. It's not difficult to get to though. And at least in 2013, you could see how the market was pricing companies, pricing it based on how many users does this company have. So as you look across all of these examples, and you looked at examples ranging from mature companies to growth companies, with pricing, you're trying to use what the market is doing as the basis for attaching a pricing to your company. Okay. Any questions? Okay, let's talk about pricing across the entire market. mean, so far I've stayed sector focused, right? I've taken beverages, I've taken banks, but I've stayed within the sector. But if you can control for differences across companies, why am I stuck with sectors? Why can't I look across the entire market? Saying you can't do that. There'd be differences in growth and risk and cash flows. You're right. But what if I could control for those differences? So the start of every year, here's what I do. I take every publicly traded company, and I've been doing this in the US for the longest time. So I've been doing it almost 30 years. I take the PE ratio of every US company. And then I look at growth and payout and risk and try to explain differences in PE ratios across all US companies using those fundamentals. In other words, I'm using what I learned when I did my analysis of a multiple using that intrinsic value model to try to explain differences. So start of 2021, I took the PE ratios for every company. I took the expected growth and earnings per share for every company. And I did a scatter plot. I wanted to see, because people kept telling me high growth companies have high PE ratios. I said, is that true? Let's see what the market's doing. Well, the good news is on average, they're right. Higher growth companies have higher PE ratios, but you can also see it's an incredibly noisy relationship. Look at how much the points fall off the line. There are about, now I think, 1,500 points. If you really wanted to count every one of these points as an individual company's PE ratio and growth rate. And I said, okay, let me try this. Let's see if I can explain difference in PE ratios across all companies. So this is across all US companies. I'm running a regression of PE ratio against payout ratio, beta, and growth in earnings per share. If you're wondering where those variables come from, those are the variables that popped up when I did that dividend discount model adjustment of what is it that drives PE ratio. So this isn't a kitchen sink regression. You know what a kitchen sink regression is? We've all been guilty of those in statistics classes, where essentially the end game is to get the highest R squared you can. You can throw everything but the kitchen sink in there. This is just, I'm restricting myself to those three variables. Let's start with the decent news. Not great news, but decent news. The R squared is 40%. That's pretty good when you're trying to explain P ratios across all US companies. If you look at the coefficients, at least for payout and growth, make sense. Higher payout and higher growth companies have higher P ratios, which you should expect. But the coefficient beta is a little puzzling. Usually a higher risk company should have lower P ratios, but here you see a positive coefficient. In other words, higher beta companies seem to have higher P ratios. Now we'll talk about why that might be happening, but before I leave this regression, I also checked out the T statistics. Remember the very simple rule of thumb I suggested in the last session. I'm looking to see whether they're greater than two. Clearly payout and growth have T statistics well in excess of what I'd need them to be. But beta is pretty marginal, 0.63. Now, first, whenever you run these regressions, I mean, there are standard issues you run into. Is it linear, non-linear? In this case, I've imposed a linear relationship. No? And that might not be true. The second is the relationship itself might be unstable. As you do these regressions, they might change over time, and these regressions are unstable. And the third is an issue that anytime you run a multiple regression statistics, you run into, which is the independent variables in a multiple regression are supposed to be uncorrelated with each other. And there's almost no chance you're going to find that to be true with any financial regression. Because you pick any three variables related to a company, they're bound to be linked to each other. It doesn't kill your regression, but it's something that you got to keep in the background. So let's start with what to do about variables like the beta variable in the regression where the T statistic is not significant. Don't sit there again fighting the data. If a variable is not statistically significant, it's not carrying its weight, don't leave it in the regression. It's just adding noise to your overall regression. You know what I mean by adding noise? It's putting a number in there that it shouldn't even be in there. So here's the rule. Whenever you see a variable be statistically insignificant, take it out of the regression. I'm going to take beta out. And if I take beta out, my regression comes back to two variables, just payout and growth. But you're saying, but beta should matter. Remember what I said with pricing? What you and I think should matter is irrelevant. What the market thinks matters is all that you put in. In this case, payout and growth stay in the regression. My R squared dropped a little bit, but I can live with it. It's a better regression because I've taken out the noise I had by having betas. Once in a while though, when you run this regression, the coefficient, my coefficient was actually okay, 5.913, but that coefficient can sometimes be a negative number. In statistics, it's not a big deal, but in pricing, it can be a big deal. And here's why. When you have a negative intercept, you can sometimes get negative predicted values. And that makes no sense if you're looking at PE ratios. Your PE ratio cannot be negative. So if you have a regression where the intercept is negative, in most statistics packages, Minitab has this, SPSS, SAS, whatever you're using, and even Excel has this as an option. There's an option you can use when you run a multiple regression, where you say, take the constant out of the regression. So what it does, it forces the line through the, so it, instead of having the line go wherever it wants through the axis, it forces it through zero. So your constant disappears. You don't do this unless you absolutely have to, because your regression gets to be a less, it's not as good a fit anymore, the line is, but you don't have this negative intercept problem. So in fact, 2 years ago, I think when I ran this regression, the intercept was negative. I reran the regression without the intercept. Beta growth, it works perfectly okay. And finally, let's talk about this multicollinearity issue, which is if your independent variables are correlated with each other, it's called multicollinearity. And as I said, whenever you run a regression in markets and you use things like growth and cash flows and payout, they're almost guaranteed to be correlated with each other. Take a look, for instance, if I look at growth rate, for instance, there's a negative correlation with payout. Companies with higher payout tend to have lower growth, which makes sense. Companies with higher growth rate also have lower betas, which again makes sense. So the variables we're using are correlated with each other. So in statistics classes, they do a big song and dance about multicollinearity. Now there are two things you can do when you have multicollinearity. You can try to find other variables that are not correlated with each other, but that's never going to be possible in finance. Or you can just live with the multicollinearity. When you have multicollinearity, as we do, it doesn't mean the regression cannot be used. It means the coefficients you see on the variables might have the wrong sign. Remember for beta, I got a positive sign instead of a negative sign. That's not because beta doesn't matter. It just means that high beta companies tend to have high growth and the computer's really confused about what exactly beta is measuring. Is it measuring risk or is it measuring growth? But the overall regression can still be used to make predictions. So cut the long story short, if you have multicollinearity, in fact, I'm not even going to say, if when you have multicollinearity in your regression, don't worry about it. Just still use the regression to get predicted values for your company. It'll still work because it's really not worth the effort of trying to make it go away. So let's see how this regression can help you price an individual company. So let's say it's the start of 2021. You came to me with Disney and you said, hey, do you think Disney is overpriced or underpriced? Now I could do a big intrinsic valuation of Disney, but let's say I don't have the time. I have this regression in front of me. Remember in the regression without the beta coefficient, here's what my regression looks like. 5.91 plus 17.10 times payout plus 228.4 times growth rate. That's basically the regression. You come to me and you tell me Disney has a growth rate of 15%. And a payout ratio of 20%. I'm going to plug in 0.15 as my, I'm sorry, 0.2 as my payout, 0.15 as my growth rate. I'll get a predicted PE. I don't remember what it was, but if any of you plug it in, you could probably tell me. I think I got a predicted PE of 32. You're saying, what does that mean? Given Disney's existing growth rate and payout ratio, it should be trading at 32 times earnings. It's actually trading at 35 times earnings. That would make Disney overpriced. And I do this with every single stock in the market. You know what? I could be a one-person hedge fund. The 50 companies that come out as most underpriced from the regression will be my buys. The 50 companies that come out as most overpriced will be my sells. And then I sit and hope and pray that every point moves towards the regression line. That's a part I don't control. But think of this as a very simplistic version of quant investing, which is this big area in investing right now, is this is what quant investors try to do, is they try to take the data. They're not interested in valuation. Quant investing is never about valuation, it's about pricing. But they take the data and they try to extract as much information as they can from the data as to which stocks are underpriced and which stocks are overpriced. Any questions about this market regression? So basically, market regressions look across all stocks in the market. Then you're using that regression to get predicted numbers for individual companies. Now, what are the variables I've kept track of over time in these regressions? If you look at the coefficient on growth rate, 228.40, I've tracked that coefficient going back to 2000. And let's go back to 2000. 2000, the market was paying 2.1 for every extra 1% of growth. It was paying a high price for growth, wasn't charging very much for risk. The risk premium was low, and the price that market was paying for growth was really high. This was nirvana for high growth, high risk companies. Do you see why? The market's paying a huge premium for growth, not charging very much for risk. That's the peak of the dot-com boom. 1 year later, look at what happened. The market, the price the market's paying for growth has dropped off. Markets are less willing to pay for growth. They're charging much more for risk. That's the start of the adjustment from the dot-com boom. So what you're looking for as an investor here is, what is the market paying for an extra 1% of growth? Right now it's 2.28. That's high by historical standards. And what's the market charging for risk? And 4.72% is low by historical standards. When the market's paying a lot for growth and not charging very much for risk, as I said, high growth companies are going to be treated really well in the market. That's where we are right now. Could that change? Absolutely. It's happened before. I'd be curious to see what January 22 looks like after we've gone through this COVID adjustment. My prediction is that this price for that extra 1% of growth is going to decrease. The risk premium might be a little higher. But that's what the rest of this year is going to be about, is how is the market going to price growth and risk? And this is just a very simple snapshot of what the market is paying right now. Any questions on the market regression? Let me try one more multiple, and I'm going to do this for a specific reason, because it goes to this linearity question, because as I said, I use a linear regression because it's the most convenient. So I wanted to do this for the PEG ratio. Remember, the PEG ratio is PE divided by growth rate. And we know growth still continues to matter. So I did a graph, a scatter plot of PEG versus growth. I know this is overreaching. When I looked at this graph, my first sensation was, this is not linear. I'm getting a graph where the line runs something like this, right? If you look at the points. So I did something that I find works 90% of the time for me whenever I have a non-linear relationship between two variables. I took the growth rate and took the natural log of that growth rate. So this is PEG ratio against the log of growth. Compare the two graphs. This is PEG ratio versus growth. This is PEG versus log of growth. I might be again imagining it, but this relationship looks a lot more linear than the previous one. So what are you going to do with it? When I ran my PEG ratio regression, instead of using growth as my variable, I used the log of the growth rate. That's the only difference. Once you've established that something is a nonlinear relationship, just take that variable, take the natural log of it. It's amazing how well it works in removing nonlinearities, at least in financial regressions. The R squared of this regression, pretty low. Am I disappointed? With pricing, this is basically what the data is giving me. I'm not going to be disappointed or happy, because it is what it is. If you look at the T statistics, they're all statistically significant. Higher payout ratio companies have higher PEG ratios, higher growth companies have lower PEG ratios, and higher risk companies have lower PEG ratios. The coefficients make sense. So if you gave me a Disney and said, what is the right PEG ratio for Disney? I can plug the numbers into this regression and get a predicted PEG ratio. So I'm going to end this part by looking at just a series. I'm just going to present you with a series of results from the start of 2021. Because here's what I do. You've seen the PE and PEG ratio regressions for the US. I do price to book regressions, EV to EBITDA, EV to sales, EV to invested capital, six regressions for the US. But then I do the six regressions for global stocks, for European stocks, for emerging market stocks. In other words, I run these regressions by region and for the entire globe. There's no theory behind these regressions. This is what the data gave as output as I looked at the start of 2021. So first, I ran PE regressions for US, Europe, Japan, emerging markets, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, global, using beta, payout, and growth for every single region. First thing to notice is there are more similarities across regions than differences because the patterns are the same, but clearly there are differences in the actual coefficients. The R squares also vary widely. I did my best with US stocks and my worst with European stocks in trying to explain differences in PE ratios. If you gave me a European company and asked me, is this correctly priced? I could take the European PE ratio regression, plug in the values for your company and come up with a predicted PE ratio for your company. I now have at least on one page, all of the regressions I need to get a predicted PE for any company, no matter where it is in the world. When I did PEG ratios, same process. I repeated this in every part of the world, same variable. So again, I'm using the same intuition to start, but the data used very different results. And with the PEG ratios, I was best able to explain differences for Japanese companies, and I had my worst time with US companies. This is not about the US data always giving me the best results. It depends on the month. With PE ratios, the US data work best. With PEG ratios, Japanese companies were easier to explain. When I looked at price to book, notice again, same four variables, beta, payout, growth, and return on equity. Notice return on equity is the dominant variable in every single part of the world. No matter where you go in the world, if you ask me what drives price to book, it's difference in return on equity. Manav?
So Professor, so what I was, if you roll back a few slides back to that regression graph,
One more.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking like, yeah, even this one or the next slide to this, right, where you took a log. So I was thinking like this, so much of standard error, the data can be like all the way to 10 to peg to all the way to zero for each.
And that's what the R squared would say. Again, you can't find the data. You know why there's a lot of standard error? Because no one variable is going to be able to explain any multiple, right? So even if you take, it gets better when you look at price to book versus return equity. ROE does a much better job, but PE ratios, no single variable does a very good job in explaining differences in PE ratios across companies. And that's why I said, don't fight the data. It's not your fault. This is the way it is. And when people push me and say, how can you use this? You know what my response is? I wanted to do intrinsic valuation in the first place. You're the one who pushes towards pricing. This is what the data is telling you. Pricing is incredibly noisy. All the regression's doing is holding up a mirror to the noise, saying, look how noisy it is. Use it at your own risk. So you're absolutely right. And that's what the R squares are capturing. And with the PEG ratio, the R squared is only 12%. There's a huge amount of variation in PEG ratios. I cannot explain. You know, the lesson I take out of that is I don't use PEG ratios. Okay. When the data gives me that much noise, I'm asking for trouble using that multiple in any pricing context. And in fact, as I go to price to book, one of the things you're going to notice is the R squares get much better. Notice the R squares here compared to the PE ratios. And that's one reason when asked to pick a multiple, PE ratios are among the most deadly multiples to use in pricing because they're so difficult to explain across companies. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you. Then I did EV to EBITDA. Again, most widely used multiple in the world. Why not try it? And I use debt ratio growth and I had to use tax rate. Remember, we talked about why tax rates still matter. EBITDA is a pre-tax number. I had to see what the tax rate did. And with EV to sales, the margin kicks in. What I'm trying to say is, look, you know, I'm not going to use a different set of rules for different parts of the world, but the data leads me to very different places in different parts of the world. And by breaking it down regionally now, no matter which multiple you pick and whichever part of the world you're in, you can find the regression that best suits you and plug the numbers in for your company. In your project, you have to do a pricing of your company relative to the sector. That's the first task I give you. And that's something you have to do. Go to Capital IQ, download the data, try different multiples. And we'll talk about which multiple best fits. I also ask you to price your company relative to the market. Notice the two differences, right? The first, I'm asking you to price it relative to your sector. Second one, I'm asking you to price it to the market. when I ask you to price your company relative to the market, what I'm asking you to do is go into these regressions, and you don't have to run a regression yourself across the market. That's way too much work, and that's something I don't expect you to do. But take one of these regressions, find the one that best fits you, whichever multiple you want, and come up with a predicted pricing for your company given this market regression. So let's summarize the pricing game, right? So you sit down to price your company. The first thing you need to do is decide whether you're going to use an equity multiple or an enterprise value multiple. Let's think about what drives that. If you have a financial service firm, if you're pricing a bank, if you're pricing an insurance company, investment bank, stick with an equity multiple. Don't even try to do enterprise value multiples. It's pointless. If you have a non-financial service firm, and there are big differences in debt ratios across your company. So you have 20 companies in your group and you see big difference in debt ratios, go with an enterprise value multiple. When leverage is wildly different across companies, equity multiples can be very dangerous. So that's your first choice, equity multiple or enterprise value multiple. Second, you have to decide on a scaling variable. Should I use revenue? Should I use book value? Should I use earnings? Here's a very simple thing to look at. If you have 20 companies in your sector and only four are making money, don't use an earnings multiple for a very simple reason. You're going to end up with only four companies. The more companies in your sector where you're unable to use a multiple, the more you should move away from it. And in a sector where most companies are losing money, guess what? Use revenue multiples. You're saying, is that the best multiple? It's not even a question of best. It's the only one you can actually try in the sector and get away with. Third choice you have to make is what period are you going to use for your scaling variable? You know what I mean by that? Are you going to use earnings in the last 12 months, earnings in the next 4 months, earnings in the last 12 months, the next 12 months, earnings in 2019, earnings in 2025? You know what my answer to that is? Use whatever works, but be consistent. If you decide to go with 2025 earnings for one company, you got to do it for all of them. And finally, you have to make a judgment on what you're going to call comparable. Are you going to stay geographically in just your country? Which if you're a US company, the option is always there. But if you're doing a Turkish company, and you say, I'm going to use only Turkish companies, you might be constraining yourself too much. So that choice is going to be driven by when you get into capital IQ and you start screening for geographies, are you getting enough companies to be able to do pricing? So pick EV or equity. What you're going to scale it to, how you're going to time it, and what your peer group looks like. So I'm going to close pricing with a couple of very general propositions. When you do the pricing for your company, and you tell me that something is undervalued or overvalued, you're making a conditional statement. And Genoa pointed this out. The conditional statement you're making is this company looks cheap relative to these other companies. That's all you're saying. You're not saying it's cheap, but it's cheap relative to these other companies. So you could be right on your pricing and still find your stock drop 30%, right? Your entire sector could be overpriced. Second, let's be very, very honest about the fact that when you do pricing, even if you find 15 companies that you think are just like your company, there'll still be differences between your company and those companies on growth and cash flows and risk. And you need to come up with sensible ways of controlling for those differences. I've offered you one option, which is statistical run a regression. If you don't like that, you've got to come up with something that actually makes sense that allows you to control for the differences. And the final is maybe we should stop using the word value when we use multiples and comparables. We're pricing things, and maybe we should just use the word pricing to clearly distinguish between what you're trying to do here and what you're trying to do with the DCF. So I'm going to review the four steps to kind of deconstruct multiples. Start by defining the multiple. Make sure it's consistently defined and uniformly estimated, right? Remember, price to EBITDA doesn't work. Price to sales, very dangerous. Second, describe the multiple. Get friendly with your data. Use statistical tools to get a sense of what's high, what's low, what's typical. Third, analyze the multiple. Go back to a discounted cash flow model, a dividend discount model for an equity multiple, an enterprise value model for a firm multiple. Figure out the variables that drive this multiple. And only then should you apply the multiple. Define, describe, analyze, apply. pricing is an exercise in data analysis. It's not financial theory. It's pragmatic. That's why when you do use social media companies, I was willing to use number of users. You can't tell me that's right or wrong. That's what the market's basing the pricing on. I mean, who are, you know, we're not in a position to tell the market it's wrong. When pricing, we're taking the market for what it's telling you and building it into our pricing. Any questions about pricing in general? So I would encourage you, because this is all that's left on your project, is to complete the pricing. It's really, you know, if you, you know, are willing to spend a couple of hours in Capital IQ, download the data, I mean, your pricing could be done in 2 to 3 hours. This is not like DCFs where you have to sit there and project out things. You're basically letting the market tell you what to do. Now get the pricing out of the way, use that very simple choice template I gave you on deciding what the right kind of multiple is for your company. Any questions about pricing? So, you know, you can use, you know, the nice thing about pricing is you can use it in any group of assets, in real estate, in equities, and bonds. You're pricing based on what the market's willing to pay for other things just like yours. So I'm going to take a little detour here, right? I've talked about intrinsic valuation. We've now talked about pricing, and I'm going to talk about real options in a little while. But I'm going to take a detour and talk about what's called asset-based valuation. In asset-based valuation, rather than value the company, you value pieces of the company. You value individual assets. And you can do an intrinsic valuation or a pricing, but basically you're trying to value a company from the ground up. I think of it as balance sheet-based valuation, where you take each item on the balance sheet and say, what's the value of that? What's the value of that? What's the value of that? Saying, why would I ever want to do it? Here are the scenarios where you might be asked to do an asset-based valuation. If you've come into a company, the company is planning to liquidate. What is it going to do when it liquidates? It's going to sell off pieces for the best price possible. You have to do an asset-based valuation because you have to figure out what each piece will bring. So in liquidation, you'll often see asset-based valuation. The second is if you're an accountant and you have to do fair value accounting, increasingly fair value accounting requires you to break your company down into pieces and tell in the balance sheet what each piece is worth. Remember what we talked about when we talked about brand name valuation, how accountants increasingly want to put value of a brand name as a separate asset. And here's the third context in which you might do asset-based valuation. You're an activist investor. You're targeting a multi-business company that you think is badly managed and badly run. And here's your end plan. After you take over the company, here's what you want to do. You want to break it up and sell off the parts as businesses, but basically each business is going to be sold off. A sum of the parts valuation, because you believe this company is worth more as the sum of its parts than it is as a full standalone company with all those businesses embedded in the company. So what I'd like to do is talk about how to do asset-based valuation. And I'll tell you the things that, you know, when you think about doing asset-based valuation, you're saying, why isn't this a different way of doing valuation? To do asset-based valuation, I have to make a choice because to attach a value to an asset, I can do an intrinsic valuation of each asset, right? Cash flows, discount rates, growth rates, or I can do a pricing of each asset. I might even do, you know, in some cases, take the book value of an asset and say, that's what it's worth because I'm too lazy or I don't have the information. So I'm going to take a company and take you through the process of valuing a company. And the reason I'm going to be able to do a sum of the parts valuation of the company is it's a company with separable businesses. It's in multiple businesses, but the businesses are separated from each other. You see why that's critical? Because if businesses are interlinked, it's much more difficult to value each business separately. Trying to do a multi-business valuation of Disney is going to be a nightmare. And here's why. The value of the theme parks is linked up to the value of the movie business, right? Because their movies provide the characters that go into the theme park. The value of streaming, how are you going to separate that from the value of the broadcasting business and the movie business? Because the Avengers shows are the biggest shows on streaming. So in Disney, it's going to be much more difficult to do a sum of the parts valuation than it is in a company where the pieces are separated. If each piece has its own earnings and cash flows, it gets even easier because then I can value each piece separately. But if I want to do a pricing, if each piece is in a different market where I can get a pricing for that piece separately, again, it's much easier. If you gave me a company that's composed of 8 real estate properties in different parts of the country, and you asked me to do a sum of the parts pricing, my job is pretty easy, right? I take your 3 Boston properties and price them against other Boston properties. I take your 2 New York properties and price them against other New York properties, and your 3 LA properties and price them against other LA properties. And I come up with an overall price in the company. Each property is separated. They're separable. Each property has its own cash flows, and each property has, you know, similar assets that I can use to price the property. So let's take the context in which you're going to see asset-based valuation. Let's think about what you're going to try to do. Liquidation valuation, you shouldn't be doing an intrinsic valuation. You should be doing a pricing because you're trying to sell these assets rather than value them. It's easier to do a liquidation valuation when you have a collection of assets than if you have a whole company. So in the context, you know, if you're involved in distress companies, this might be why you're doing an asset-based valuation. Is you're doing essentially a valuation because you want to sell off the pieces. And again, my advice is do a pricing of each piece. Don't do an intrinsic valuation. If you're doing accounting valuation, I think accountants need to make up their mind because it's called fair value accounting. But that's a lie. And here's why. I remember about 20 years ago when the fair value accounting rules were being written, I got a call from somebody involved in writing those rules. And they said, look, we're going to have a panel meeting in New York about how to write the fair value accounting rules. Would you be willing to come in and talk to us? And I said, are you sure you got the right person? Because I don't think that highly of accountants. They said, no, we'd like to talk about that. So I said, okay, now send me what you're thinking about. And they send me this rule called FAS 157. That's a rule in FASB. That's a rule. And if you look at FAS 157, this is what accountants are asked to do. They're assigned to attach value to assets or liabilities that market participants will be willing to pay for those assets. That's how the rule is actually stated. What market participants will be willing to pay for that asset. Think about it. When you give me a task of assessing what market participants would be willing to pay for something, you're asking me to price it, not value it, right? That's what pricing is what would somebody pay for this right now? So I wrote back and said, why is this called fair value accounting? Shouldn't it be called fair price accounting? They said, what are you talking about? I said, you're asking me to price the assets, which has nothing to do with value, it's got to do with price. They said, you're disinvited from the panel. And I said, thank you. But they left it as fair value accounting. And you know how much pain that's caused accountants since? Because accountants around the world are given this task of, hey, you come up with a fair value, but then they're also told this fair value is to be roughly what other people are willing to pay for it today, which means they have a pricing mission, but they're asked to do a discounted cash flow valuation to back up the pricing mission. It's almost impossible to reconcile. Until fair value accounting confronts this question of, are you interested in value or price? You're going to get this insane amount of confusion about what do we do? How do we attach numbers to assets? Because you don't have your mission right. Which brings me to sum of the parts valuation. As I said, activist investors increasingly are targeting multi-business companies because they want to split them up and sell off the pieces. And as an activist investor, to the extent that you're doing this because you want the underlying cash flows, you could argue that this is one of the few arenas where you might actually want to do an intrinsic valuation of the pieces to see what each piece is worth. But to do that, you need information on each piece. So I keep looking for companies where I have the pieces in place. And this is one of the companies that I did a long time ago in 2009, I valued a company called United Technologies. At that time, I called it the poor person's GE because it, you know, GE is in 26 different businesses. You know, 2009, United Technology was in 6 different businesses. I'll go through the businesses because many of them are household names. The first division was called Carrier. It did refrigeration systems. The second is Pratt & Whitney, which is a defense company. The third is Otis, which makes elevators, a construction company. Basically, you've seen Otis elevators. The fourth was UTC Fire and Security, which is a security company. Hamilton Sensorin, which was a manufacturing company, and Sikorsky, which makes helicopters, an aircraft company. They're all part of United Technologies, different business. One of the nice things about United Technologies actually break down metrics by business. So it's not just revenues. They give you revenues, EBITDA. So these were the six metrics that they broke down by business. So here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to value United Technology as the sum of its parts, right? Each business separately. But before I do that, I also have to tell you that in addition to breaking their revenues and expenses down, they told me that $408 million in corporate G&A that was unallocated. Hold on to that thought because I can't just ignore it. It's not going to go away. When I value United Technologies as a company, that expense has to be dealt with. So let's do pricing first, because that should be the easier thing to do. And to do pricing, here's what I did. I took the EBITDA for each of the six businesses. I looked at the median EBITDA for other companies in the sector. I multiplied the EBITDA by EBITDA. I get a pricing for each business. My sum of the parts pricing for United Technologies using just the multiple at which is a very rough. So if you gave me 5 minutes, the end of dinner, and said, what would you do as a pricing? Well, 61.6 billion or 61.7 billion would be about my estimate. You see why it's rough, right? I've applied the median EBITDA for every one of these companies. I'm ignoring the 408 million in corporate G&A. If I wanted to get a little more picky, here's what I could do. I could allow for different multiples in each business. I'm not constrained to use EBITDA for all six. It might not be the best multiple. In this case, for instance, I used EBITDA for two, EV to revenues for two, and EV to invested capital for two. I actually ran regressions of companies in the sector for each of the sectors. And the regressions all have pretty decent R-squareds. So what I'm doing here, instead of using the median multiple, I'm going to use a multiple that controls for differences in margins. With those predicted multiples, basically, I get a value which is higher, which basically tells me that I was unfair to United Technology by just applying the median. So this is still a pricing, but it's a pricing that's a little more refined. I've adjusted for differences. These are both sum of the parts pricing. One is a very simplistic pricing. The other is a more sophisticated pricing, but they're both pricing. But I could do an intrinsic valuation of each piece, right? Remind me again, what do I need to do an intrinsic valuation of each piece? I need to get free cash flows. I need growth rates. I need a cost of capital. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to do a discounted cash flow valuation of each piece. And the first thing I did was I computed a cost of capital for each piece. And the way we approach estimating cost of capital, I can do this with any division, right? I don't need a market cap or a regression beta. So I get different levered betas for different pieces. Now I actually use the same debt ratio. They're all pretty high infrastructure businesses. I ended up with cost of capital that range from 6.78% for their security business to 9.94% for their construction business. So for each business, I've come up with a different cost of capital. To get to my cash flows, I started by looking at return on capital and reinvestment rate in each business. And you can already see that these are very divergent businesses. Their very best business in terms of return on capital is their elevator business, where they make 35.7%. Their worst business is the security business, where they make 6%. Because they gave me enough of a breakdown, I was able to come up with how much reinvestment they had, and varies across businesses. They reinvest the least in the elevator business, the most in the security business. So I've got a reinvestment rate. Remember, return on capital times reinvestment rate is your expected growth rate. So that's what you see as my growth rate. I allowed for five of these businesses to have high growth, and one of them, security business, I viewed as a mature business. So basically what I'm doing is essentially treating each part of United Technologies as a standalone business, estimating its cash flows, estimating the cost of capital, and coming up with the value of each business. And here's what I ended up with as my value for each. So this is just basically each business. I'm doing a free cash flow, the firm cost of capital. The sum of those values is 80.25 billion. This is a sum of the parts valuation of United Technologies. There's one loose end though that I haven't tied up. In each of these six businesses, I've taken cash flows, discounted back at the cost of capital, come up with the value. I get 80.25 billion. You know what the loose end is? I've got 408 million in corporate G&A that's just hanging out there. I can be a cynic and say that's completely waste. I'm going to completely ignore it. But I'm not going to do that because that's not realistic. Those G&A costs are really costs from these six businesses that have been pooled at the corporate level. So here's what I did as my final step. I took the 408 million, it's the corporate G&A. It's tax deductible, so I multiplied by one minus the tax rate. I treated it as a growing perpetuity, saying these expenses are going nowhere. And what I got as a present value was $4.58 billion. You subtract that from the 80.25, the value that I get for the operating assets based on a DCF is 75.7 billion. In fact, I can line them all up. The value that I got with my sophisticated pricing was 74 billion. The value of just the operating assets, if I do the company overall, is 71 billion. The values I get are pretty close actually, 71 through 76 billion. Its actual enterprise value was 53 billion when I did this. This was a company that looked to me like it was undervalued no matter which way I approached the valuation, top down, bottom up, pieces, overall. But basically, when people talk about sum of the parts valuation, hold their feet to the fire. Because most of the time when they say, I've done a sum of the parts valuation, what they've done is a pricing. Very similar to what I showed you. They take a multiple, apply it to each group's EBITDA and say, this is the sum of the parts pricing. But to truly do an intrinsic valuation of each part requires a lot more work. About 3 years ago when GE was starting to get into the throes of its troubles, I decided to break GE down into its businesses and try to do a sum of the parts valuation of GE. Now, this is not the GE of 2006. There have been 25 different businesses. This is a slimmed down version. They still have eight different businesses. You're saying, why are some yellow, some green, and some red? This is my judgment call because the green businesses are their good businesses. Their aviation, healthcare, and transportation are good businesses because they're earning solid returns on capital, well above the cost of capital. The yellow businesses are kind of neutral businesses, power, renewable energy, oil and gas. They're earning roughly their cost of capital. The red are their two bad businesses, lighting and capital. GE Capital, which was this giant that made GE the success it was in the 1990s and made, you know, Jack Welch a legend, is now this huge drag on the company, earning a return on capital that's actually negative. This is the problem that GE has faced in the last few years. The biggest part of GE, which is GE Capital, has now become this anchor that's weighing the company down. But if I value each piece, which is what I've done there, here's what I get. I get a value of about, you know, at the time that I did this, in the net of debt of about 94.8 billion, breaking it down to pieces. But GE Capital is just a nightmare. It's what, and there's no easy way to disentangle it. Saying, why didn't they just shut it down? The problem with GE Capital is it's also the financing arm they've used when they've sold aircraft engines. It's become so entangled in the rest of the company that there's no easy way to get rid of it. But both United Technologies and GE, you can see that I have enough information to do this at the company level. Incidentally, you can do this on any company. If you ask me to value Peloton's subscription business and its fitness equipment business separately, could I do it? Yes, but here's my constraint. Peloton doesn't do what United Technologies does of breaking every number down by business. I could take Coca-Cola and value each geography differently. I could take the US market, the Asia, and do each piece. And again, if I had the information, I could do it. And with intrinsic valuation, you can do it in pieces, you can do it as a whole. As long as you stay consistent, it should still work. And finally, I priced the parts of GE just like I did the pricing United Technology, where I took the EBITDA, applied EV to EBITDA, came up with the pricing. Incidentally, the value that I got for GE with my sum of the parts valuation was about $11 per share. With pricing, it was about $12. Stock was actually trading at $8.50 when I did this. Ended up buying GE, going through a lot of pain on the stock. It dropped as low as 6, I think, at its worst. But I think that until you resolve this GE capital issue, there's going to be no sudden escape to $25 or $30 per share. The company's always going to be bound down by what to do with this big part of the company that has now become this dump on value. It's actually pulling value down. Any questions about either the United Technologies or the GE valuation? Manav?
So Professor, so you said you labeled them yellow, green, and red. I was thinking what your views about oil and gas sector, they're part of the business. Why is still yellow, not red?
Well, because, you know, that's a good question, because if you look at the return on capital, it's heading towards the red very quickly, right? It's 3.71%. So it's the only reason was if you look at a 10-year average, you know, and you look at what happened. So you could blame this on lower oil prices. So maybe it was just hopeful thinking. Maybe today, if I did this, oil and gas would end up being in the red as well. No. Their business, but their what they call their oil and gas business is not actually extraction. It's actually providing equipment and other stuff to the oil and gas companies. So maybe today, if I did this, would be a red business. But you can see there are a couple of very good businesses in GE that are being weighed down by the bad businesses. But because you can't get rid of the bad business, you're kind of stuck with the good and the bad when you buy GE. Many older companies, this is an exercise you can go through, right? They're in multiple businesses. They got into them over time, and you can look to see which businesses are good, which are bad, and then try to do a sum of the parts valuation. But it's not obvious that you can get rid of those bad businesses, even if you wanted to.
Thank you.
Professor, just to follow up on the sum of its parts. So there are a lot of global companies have these like shared services. Obviously, you know, they provide services to different parts of the organization. So how do you think about those?
That's the corporate G&A part. It's usually a cost, right? That's what the $408 million here is really all those shared services. Maybe they have one accounting department taking care of all of these six divisions, right? Because you don't need different accountants for different parts. The $408 million is a cost, right? Go ahead.
So you don't think about the value those shared services add to the organization?
Well, you could, right? I could allocate the $408 million, but then I have to decide, do I allocate based on revenue? So rather than do that, I'm going to say, look, this is a corporate level cost. I know the corporate cost of capital. I'm going to take that present value of the cost and subtract it out from my overall value. Now, if I'd allocated this expense to my divisions, I'd have lowered the EBITDA at each division and come up with lower. So there are two choices. You can either allocate across the divisions and get rid of this shared cost, or you can treat it as a corporate cost, a deadweight cost that you take the present value of and reduce from your overall intrinsic valuation. If you're doing a pricing, do the former. If you're doing an intrinsic valuation, my suggestion is the latter is probably a better way to do it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I'm going to end with that. I know it's early, but you know we went through a lot of stuff there. So I would like you to negotiate your way through those slides. And if you get a chance, go back and, I mean, I've returned most, I mean, at least I think I've returned all the DCFs that got sent to me with, you know, kind of minimalist comments. But take that very long email that I sent you yesterday, because that's a template I use so that, you know, you can do it yourself if you want to kind of scan what I'm looking for. One of the things I would strongly suggest, and this is directed to those of you who were dealing, kept their numbers in thousands, because when you do things in thousands, you end up with 10 digits, 11 digits, 12 digits. It's don't go looking for trouble. When you have thousands, shift them to millions. It's much easier to deal with compact numbers than, and for God's sakes, don't use mathematics. And I got some of you doing E to 10. This isn't math. I mean, don't actually put the dollar value, you know, do it in millions. It makes it much easier to deal with than dealing it in thousands or actual units. Okay. So no other questions. I'm going to wrap up for the day and I will see you on Wednesday. Yeah.
Thank you.